This is an audio essay from the EI podcast. The writer Josh McLaughlin takes us on a journey through the art of choreography, one of English literature's most elusive forms. Read by Leighton Pugh.
The Lost Art of Choreography by Josh McLaughlin. This dear, dear land. John of Gaunt's deathbed elegy for this sceptred isle in Richard II, 1597, is one of the most famous speeches in Shakespeare, still quoted 400 years later as patriotism or critique in wartime propaganda, television dramas, parliamentary speeches, and anti-littering adverts. This England is a classic political set piece. But Gaunt's mournful celebration of this precious stone set in the Silver Sea, this blessed plot, whose rocky shore beats back the envious siege of watery Neptune, is also part of another tradition, the lost art of choreography. Although nature and travel writing remain established forms, choreography has been largely undeservedly forgotten in the literary landscape. Yet this Protean form, deriving from the Greek choros, place, and graphia, writing, combining geography and topography, social and cultural history, antiquarianism and mythology, panegyric and lament, is a vital chapter in intellectual history. It was not just Shakespeare's dramas that were profoundly influenced by choreography, but much of the literary culture of early modern England, including the work of Philip Sidney, Edmund Spenser, Ben Jonson, John Milton, and Thomas Hobbes. The story of choreography, though, begins in the ancient world. Ptolemy's Geography, circa 149 AD, began by stating that geography is a representation in picture of the whole known world together with the phenomena which are contained therein, whereas choreography, selecting certain places from the whole, treats more fully of the particulars, even dealing with the smallest localities, such as harbours, farms, villages, river courses, and such like, as if one were to paint only the eye or the ear by itself. Ptolemy thus frames choreography as an art of place. If geography has need of mathematics, he said, then choreography needs an artist. Classical thinkers tended to emphasize the illustrative and cartographic aspects and visual literacy of the form. Later, medieval scholars began to realize more fully the etymology of choreography as place writing. The introduction to the Benedictine monk Ranulf Higden's Polychronicon, circa 1340, for example, combined both time and place, albeit on the vast cosmological and global scale typical of medieval universal chronicles. Higden offered descriptions of towns, roads, rivers, ecclesiastical jurisdictions, dialects, flora and fauna of Britain, drawn from Bede, Gerald of Wales, and Geoffrey of Monmouth. In the 16th century, English lay scholars fused humanist methods of source criticism with an increasingly sophisticated sense of anachronism and the emergent techniques of material and philological antiquarianism, revitalizing choreography as an erudite yet literary form. Richard Helgeson writes in Forms of Nationhood, 1992, that choreography is the genre devoted to place, as chronicle is the genre devoted to time. In practice, however, it was often difficult to separate history from geography and choreography. The royalist polemicist and historian Peter Heylin wrote in Microcosmos, 1621, that as geography without history hath life and motion, but at random and unstable, so history without geography, like a dead carcass, hath neither life nor motion at all. Choreography, then, was not quite history, yet could not help verging on to the historical, because it dealt with the remains of the past, natural and human, that endured in the present, whether preserved intact Aura's ruins, ghosts, folk tales, or the indexes of environmental change, such as erosion, clearance, reclamation, and drainage. Such questions of genre were no mere scholar's quibbles. As the historian Daniel Wolfe says in The Idea of History in Early Stuart England, 1990, antiquaries and chorographers sought to distance themselves from the narrative historians and chroniclers due to the sword of Damocles looming over those who ventured onto sensitive political territory, or worse, commented on current events through historical analogies. The most famous cautionary tale was that of John Heywood, whose Life and Reign of King Henry IV, 1599, landed him in the Tower of London, thanks to a fawning dedication, in expectation of future time, to Robert Devereux, the second Earl of Essex, who launched a botched rebellion against the ageing Elizabeth in 1601. It was these dangers that led William Camden, author of the Latin Britannia, or a chorographical description of the most flourishing kingdoms, England, Scotland, and Ireland, 1856, translated 1610, to shrink from examining politics and monarchical history. Remembering myself to be a chorographer, leaving these matters unto our historiographers. The flourishing of chorography in the 16th century was made possible by key advances in antiquarianism and cartography. John Leyland was commissioned in 1533 to peruse and diligently to search all the libraries of monasteries and colleges of this noble realm, to the intent that the monuments of ancient writers, as well of other nations, might be brought out of deadly darkness to lively light. Leyland never got around to writing his planned history of Britain. He suffered a mental breakdown around 1550 and never regained his sanity, but his Itineraries, 1538-43, provided raw materials for later chorographers by salvaging some of the mass of topographical, bibliographical, economic and archaeological data and ancient and medieval social, legal and cultural records unleashed by the dissolution of the monasteries from 1536 onwards. Christopher Saxton's Atlas of the Counties of England and Wales, 1579, was another key development, kick-starting an obsession with mapping and describing the nation. Saxton's work formed the basis of virtually every printed map until the advent of the Ordnance Survey in 1791. Camden called Saxton not a cartographer, but the excellent chorographer, harking back to the Ptolemaic definition of the art. In A Perambulation of Kent, 1576, the first of a wave of county chorographies, William Lambard told his reader, "My purpose specially is to write a topography or a description of places, and no chronography or story of times, although I must now and then use both, since one cannot be fully be performed without interlacing the other." Here we can see the generic hybridity of chorography as a descriptive mode, as well as the productive tension between the two narrative axes of time and space. Lambard sought to show in particular the bounds of each shire and county, the several regiments, bishopsies, lasts, hundredths, franchises, liberties, cities, markets, boroughs, castles, religious houses and schools, the ports, havens, rivers, waters and bridges, and finally the hills and dales, parks and forests, and whatsoever the singularities within every of the same. Lambard roved around his county, describing the air in Kent, somewhat thick, and the soil, for the most part bountiful, comparing Dartford to Mesopotamia, for so methinketh that this country, lying between the rivers of Darent and Medway, may well be termed, examining the gavel kind, customs of Kent that were discrepant from the common laws of our realm, and summarising the political and military history of the Cinque Ports. Eschewing the usual chronological structure of histories and chronicles, lest they be accused of composing a story of times, Choreographers like Lambard invented other narrative structures in the form of routes, moving south to north, say, or following rivers, valleys, roads, and other natural or man-made landmarks. In this way, choreographers devised ways of plotting that ran counter to the temporal logic that defined history. The mapmaker Humphrey Llwyd, or Lloyd, celebrated as the inventor of Britain at a National Library of Wales exhibition in 2019, earned renown as the author of the Latin Breviary of Britain, translated into English in 1573. It contained loving descriptions of this most noble and renowned island, combining learned discourse of the variable state and alteration thereof throughout history, together with the geographical description of the true renown of Britain. A highly respected scholar and historian in the Welsh Renaissance, Llwyd nevertheless defended Brittonic legends against the demythologizing humanist scholarship of Polydore Virgil, who poured scorn and scepticism on the tales of Arthur and Merlin, so central to Welsh and British identity and folklore. William Harrison said he never travailed 40 miles in all my life, but he wrote a magnificent description of England that served not only as an introduction to Holinshed's Chronicles, 1577, the source book for Shakespeare's histories and countless other Elizabethan and Jacobean dramas, but became famous in its own right. Harrison's choreography encompassed ancient names, rivers and waters, baths and hot wells, castles and holds, parks and warrens, ancient coins, the food and diet of the English, their apparel and attire, as well as many other spatial, social, material, economic and historical descriptions, such as English dogs, quarries of stone for building, and the dry measures of England and their comparison with others. More than any other work, however, Camden's Britannia represents the high watermark of choreography, an instant success. The original went through 5 editions before its English translation by Philemon Holland appeared in 1610. The last Latin reprint in Camden's lifetime was published in a glorious folio edition complete with maps, including Saxton's, and engravings of coins, monuments, and topographies. Camden spent years mastering the skill of the most ancient British and English-Saxon tongues, travelled all over England, looked into most libraries, registers and memorials of churches, cities and corporations, pored upon many an old roll and evidence, examined the nature of the soil and places of greatest antiquity. Yet this intense scholar and antiquarian, who diligently perused our own writers as well as the Greek and Latin ones that mentioned the least title of Britain, was also moved to panegyric. In Remains of a Greater Work Concerning Britain, 1605, bits that never made it into the Britannia, Camden lauded Britain as stored with infinite delicate fowl, walled and guarded with the ocean, watered with pleasant fishful and navigable rivers, and so rich in commodities, so beautiful in situation, so resplendent in all glory, that if the most omnipotent had fashioned the world round, like a ring, as he did like a globe, it might have been most worthily the only gem therein. This is the choreographical ore Shakespeare mines to produce Gaunt's immortal monologue. Indeed, Camden's influence on later writers is difficult to overstate. Ben Jonson praised Camden in an epigram as the man in to whom my country owes the great renown and name wherewith she goes. What name, what skill, what faith hast thou in things? What light in searching the most antique springs? What weight and what authority in thy speech? Men scarce can make that doubt, but thou canst teach. Britannia drew the highest praise from Camden's contemporaries and scholars across Europe, and its author played a vital role in the development and dissemination of scholarship. He established the Camden Professorship of Ancient History at Oxford University in 1622, which continues today, and was a founding figure, along with Sir Robert Cotton, who collected the famous library named after him, of the Society of Antiquaries. We can measure the cultural impact of Camden's masterpiece in those works that adopted and adapted his choreographical vision of Britain. Fairyland, the fantastical setting for Spenser's epic romance The Faerie Queen, 1590-1596, was peopled by historical analogies, familiar legends and magical allegories, yet it was also populated by endless monuments, ancient weapons, scrolls, relics and other remnants. Not only that, but Spenser imagined Fairyland with close attention to its physical features, including rivers, mountains, caves, coasts and, famously, the plain across which the gentle knight comes pricking in the opening of Book One. The marriage of Thames and Medway, the choreographical centrepiece of the Faerie Queen, imagines the two rivers and their peoples, regions, myths and stories, converging at a sumptuous banquet. The poem is typical of Spenser's romantic imagination, but Camden's De Connubio Tamae et Isis, on the marriage of the Thames and Isis, from Britannia, supplied the blueprint. In Shakespeare's Henry IV Part I, 1598, Hotspur, Glendower, Worcester and Mortimer, plotting to overthrow the king, examine a map of England to divide our right according to our threefold order ta'en. Hotspur demonstrates a choreographer's eye when he complains, "Methinks my moiety, north from Burton here, in quantity equals not one of yours. See how this river comes me cranking in, and cuts me from the best of all my land, a huge half-moon, a monstrous cantle out. I'll have the current in this place dammed up, and here the smug and silver trench shall run in a new channel, fair and evenly. It shall not wind with such a deep indent to rob me of so rich a bottom here." Shakespeare returned to choreography in King Lear, 1606. The famous opening scene sees the king ordering, "Give me the map there. Know that we have divided in three our kingdom," giving to Goneril shadowy forests, and with champagnes riched, with plenteous rivers and wide-skirted meads, and to Regan another ample third of our fair kingdom, before Cordelia, refusing flattery, ends up with nothing. John Stowe's Survey of London, 1598-1603, was another pioneering choreography. Before it, Stowe had written chronicles, annals, summaries and epitomes of British history, but the Survey was a different beast. Born from Stowe's love of and curiosity about his city, it cited not only wills, parish registers, livery records, and the dispersed former monastic holdings, but ballads, folk tales, and oral testimonies. Stowe's survey was also a socio-topographical history, attempting to record how London had changed culturally, economically, politically, spatially, architecturally, during a period of rapid transformation, examining tombs, muniments, epitaphs, rivers, roads, walls, bridges, wards, inns, colleges, merchants and trades, laws and customs, housing, water supply and sanitation, and divers, Roman and other antique curiosities. Camden also influenced Michael Drayton's Polyolbion, 1612-1622, a long poem annotated by the historian John Selden with a series of prose illustrations. Britain's delicacies, choreographical description, and history be my subject, Drayton said, and the choreography of this song celebrated every mountain, forest, river, and valley, expressing in their sundry postures their loves, delights, and natural situations. The title page literalised Drayton's anthropomorphism of the island, depicting Great Britain as a goddess enrobed in, what else, a map of the nation. The patriotism of choreography inevitably lent a latent political charge. The emergence of the country as a single, if variously significant, term for the focal point of allegiance, said Helgeson, parallels the emergence of the description, survey, or choreography as an autonomous and widely practiced genre. Place writing had seditious potential because it incited a different kind of loyalty. The natural affection, by far the strongest affection that is, according to Camden, for one's nation. Unlike in chronicles, royal panegyric, political biographies, or even history plays, the main character in a choreography was not the monarch or the nobility, but the country itself. We can thus trace a political pedigree in choreography from Richard II to William Blake's Jerusalem, 1810, which mourned, as Gaunt did, England's green and pleasant land. Thinking of the country as a place for everyone rather than someone's property allows us to imagine the nation independently of those who currently rule it. The travel and nature writers of the 20th and 21st centuries are the heirs of these choreographers. Patrick Lee Fermor, like the early modern philologist antiquarians, brought a polyglot's curiosity and a perambulator's love of people and places to his walking masterpiece, A Time of Gifts, 1977. Nicolas Bouvier's many travelogues turned choreographical journeys into a form of religious ecstasy. In the end, Bouvier says in L'Usage du Monde, 1963, translated as The Way of the World in 2007, the bedrock of existence is not made up of family or work or what others think or say of you, but of moments like this, when you are exalted by a transcendent power that is more serene than love. Life dispenses them parsimoniously. Our feeble hearts could not stand more. In Revisioning the Earth, 1996, Paul Devereux sought to revive the form. Choreography, not topography, place as expressively potent, place as experience, place as a trigger to memory, imagination, and mythic presence. The counterpoint to Bouvier's rapture is the cynicism of Ian Sinclair. London Orbital, 2002, conducts an autopsy on London's body politic as much as a perambulation of its hinterlands. Hungry for place, Sinclair is driven by an urge to walk to the point where London loses it, gives up its ghosts. In a more radical, macabre vision, Andy Sharp's The English Heretic Collection, Ritual History's Magical Geography, 2020, combines occult history, folk horror, and black magic, all firmly rooted in England's history, localities, and landscapes. The result is a demonic form of choreography, a roving English heretic punning and pushing back on English heritage's claim to fix the canonical meaning of the land, mapping a new geography and a new psychodramatic landscape that turns England into a cosmic mystery play. Contemporary nature writers like Mark Cocker and Richard Smith are, in a way, scions of the naturalist branch of the choreographical family tree. The tendency to elegize ecological loss in a literature of consolation, as Cocker puts it, recalls the melancholy of John Stowe, surveying the crumbling ruins, commercial blight, and decline and fall of London's material heritage at the turn of the 17th century. Choreography is one of English literature's most eccentric and mercurial forms, mixing antiquarianism, history, poetry, and geography into a patriotic paean to the land and its people. Choreography's synchronic rather than diachronic format, the precedence of place over a past or future unfolding in time, offers a window into a radical form of writing, different from history and fiction, then or now.